Last time, the problem of man, particularly the question of the individual versus the community, as it was formulated by classical philosophy. Basically, when classical philosophy spoke about the individual, it was not a relationship to the community, but to mankind. I mean, classical philosophy didn't know the concept of community. It's mankind, the universal man, Now, all these concepts, community and state, were simply, not known, to the classical philosophy as the concepts are known to us. Basically, in Greek, they didn't even have the concept of state. It was more a city government for the time. And I tried to derive from the theory of the individual certain practical conclusions. And I tried to interpret the Greek philosophy of man in moral and also in social terms, as to social welfare and so forth. Of course, we have to take up the problem of the Jewish, as the individual within Judaic thought. But before I'm going to take up this problem today, but before I do it, I would like again to see how this classical influence has asserted itself in modern philosophy with regard to the individual versus the community. When I say modern philosophy, I don't mean modern philosophy in the sense of contemporary philosophy, but more modern philosophy since the Age of Enlightenment or the Age of Reason, since the French Revolution, or about that time. Or perhaps tracing it back to the English positivists like Hume and Locke and so forth. In order to place the classical view of man in focus and to appreciate the enormous influence, and I'm doing it for the sake of contrasting, the modern approach with that of the Jewish approach. Because when you say individual, the very concept of individual is very vague, and you can interpret individual in two different ways. And to appreciate the enormous influence it exerted, the classical view of man upon the emergence of modern theories, and in order also to assess properly the significance of the revolutionary doctrine of man in Judaism, it would be advisable for us to investigate a controversy in modern philosophy relative to the problem of individual versus the community. Basically, there are two doctrines as regards this relationship, between individual and community. And in the course of this lecture, I'll show that Judaism disagrees, and I may add the adverb, violently, with both theories. But let us first see, these two opposite viewpoints, and also, realize that Judaism cannot accept either of them. Basically, there are two doctrines as regards the relationship between the individual and the community. The individualistic doctrine and the positivist, or also the idealist. The first theory, which has found its most succinct expression in the philosophy of the Enlightenment or the Age of Reason, says, the individual being is an independent entity, provided with natural prerogatives and innate rights. He enjoys full aboriginal freedom and is endowed with creative aptitudes for which he is not indebted to anyone, since he is the originator of everything. Of course, reading, for instance, the Declaration of Independence, you'll find the echo of this individualistic theory in the Declaration of Independence. At the beginning, if I may use a biblical phrase for that, at the beginning there was the individual, not society. Later came the community, the collective, which is to be understood in terms of isolated individuals who joined up and formed a society. The latter consists of single selves who retain their autonomy even after they have left their solitary abodes and united within a community. The individual is capable of managing his affairs without appealing for aid to the collective. He is self-sufficient. The I does not need the thou or the he. Of course, the meeting of all three, that means of the ha and the I, the thou and the he, and their coalescence into society, makes life simpler and more comfortable. Yet an individual isolated existence is quite thinkable and also possible. It is for a very good reason that the doctrine of individualism, who was called by theologians a Robinson Crusoe philosophy. And Dilthey, the famous German social philosopher, and Brunner, the Swiss theologian, have already pointed out that this theory, granting primacy to the individual and isolating him from the social texture into which he was woven, coincides with the attempt of classical physics and chemistry to atomize matter and to interpret holes or processes in nature in terms of particles and isolated entities. It coincides with the conceiving of big events as resultants of infinitesimal sub-appearances. This is exactly what physics does. So taking the community, atomize the community, and interpret community in terms of the individual. Interpretation of the macrocosmos as the sum total of microprocesses. Yes, and why do I quote this theory? It's well known to you. I'm advancing nothing new, because people identify this theory with the Judaic viewpoint. This is exactly what the people say. This is not the Judaic viewpoint. Whether the individual came first is a different problem, but the individual is self-sufficient, and so to say, and completely an isolated existence, and the community is something which appeared later, either by the naive concept of contract social, which is a very naive concept, or because of certain other forces which made individuals coalesce into a community. This is not the Jewish viewpoint. We'll see later on the Jewish viewpoint. Of course, the opposite view of the individualistic theory is the theory of idealism, which is directly influenced by the classical theory of man, which places man within some ideal supra-individual system. The individual is placed into a supra-individual system. The individual existence can only be understood if looked upon as a manifestation of an all-embracing higher entity, be it the class, be it mankind, and be it also, as Hegel wants to say, the objective spirit. The individual, the single person, vanishes behind the universal, the whole, the general. Whatever the individual is, whatever he possesses, his abilities, attitudes, creative talents, his experiences of a free existence, is rooted in the supra-individual unity or entity, which avails itself of the single person as an instrument of manifesting something higher and greater. I don't want to go into detail as to the different schools which deny the autonomy of the individual and see him only a medium through which something more worthy expresses itself. There are many schools. Important is only their general contention that the individual is only a part of the whole. Whether this view is formulated in universalistic Hegelian terms or in the accent of the romantic theory of organic growth, like Herder and so forth, or in the positivistic, materialistic verbiage of Marxism, then its class doctrine is irrelevant. What is significant is the conclusion that the individual serves the collective, while the individualistic doctrine of man maintains that the reverse is true. It's very usual to say here that the state serves the individual. Of course, it's very simple to say within a totalitarian system that the reverse is true. The individual serves the state. I mean, Judaism could not identify itself with either of these doctrines. We'll see later why it is so. So when I developed last time the classical theory of man, man is only a representative of the of mankind, so of course, so you might have thought that the reverse would be, so to say, subscribed to by Judaism, to the individualistic theory. That's exactly what I want, I mean, the very outset to say, the Judaism does not subscribe to the individualistic theory, as it has been formulated by the philosophers of the Age of Reason, and so forth. Judaism has a very peculiar approach to that. I just introduced these two theories. There are many more, I mean, between, but in order to show the contrast. What I want to say is now to try to develop is the Judaic interpretation of man, in particular, his relationship to the community. Question, is the individual autonomous? Is the individual, is the community supra-individualistic entity to which he must feel committed? Or on the contrary, there is no commitment on the part of the individual to the community. In contradistinction to these two basic views, basic anthropological philosophical views, Judaism has introduced a new idea of man. Let us move slowly. Answering the question which intrigued the finest minds, namely, what is man? Or, rather, as I said last time, what is the distinctive element in man? We'll find that Judaism has two distinctive elements in man. Perhaps three. But we'll discuss now just one, the first one. This is the most important one. So he said in Greek philosophy, the answer was the intellect. I showed you in Maimonides, in the guide, in the first chapter, when he speaks about Selen, Maimonides also adopts this viewpoint that man is distinct by his intellect. Because by his rational ability and capacity to understand himself and to understand his environment. And finally, to somehow to subject the environment to his own plans or ideas. Yes. This is Judaism, basic, genuine Judaism, unadulterated, I would say, by any philosophical jargon or any extraneous influences, but pristine. And between you and me, basically pristine Judaism, where are the sources if you want to get to that? Or I would say medieval philosophy of religion, of course medieval philosophy of religion, Jewish religion, who was written by great scholars, Maimonides, Halevi, Saadia, Dachian, Gelsenides, and so forth. But unfortunately, they were children of their time. And their time was moving in the orbit of the great philosophy. Greek, a bit, I mean, colored by Neoplatonic mysticism. It's a combination of Aristotelianism and Neoplatonic mysticism. Even my mind, the rationalist, is also a mystic. Because this was, so to say, the climate of the time. The rationalistic on the one hand, and the mystic on the other. And Maimonides, you never know where Maimonides is a Jewish scholar, where the Greek, the disciple of Aristotle and Plotinus. It's hard to know. Sometimes you deal with Maimonides, the Jewish scholar, and in a second, he vanishes, and he's replaced by an Aristotelian. It's hard to know sometimes. That's why the sources are not too reliable. Basically, there's only one source which is very reliable, and this is the Halacha. The Halacha is an unadulterated source. It was very far removed from the outside world. Extraneous influences did not reach the Halacha as much as they reached the philosophical mind, the Halachic scholars. It was a group for itself. And in the Halacha, the basic Jewish viewpoint came to expression. The trouble is the Halacha, as I told you, the Halacha speaks in terms of laws, in terms of legal concepts. Halakhic categories, and then you have to find a philosophical background, you get involved into a job of reconstructing out of objective data a great religious experience. It's very difficult, I told you, the passage from the objective data, the passage from technical rules of behavior to a great religious experience, to the passionate religious personality, to the homo religiosus, is a very torturous one. But we will try our best to develop out of halakhic sources, the theory of man, Because after all, the Halacha deals with man, and if it formulated laws for man, and legislated norms for him, so it must have had a fear of man, otherwise you cannot legislate. In order to legislate for somebody, he has to know this X. I mean, if it's unknown, you can't solve the equation. If there is no equation, the equation is insoluble. So you cannot say anything about it. Now I'm not quoting any laws. I have many laws, to corroborate what I say, and many stories. I have nice stories, but it's not a question of telling you stories. I have to bore you a while. Bore you, I'm a bore, but I can't help it. It should be placed in a philosophical perspective. Judaism has introduced a new idea of man. And I'm convinced about it. I'm very, as far as claims which people make on behalf of Judaism, with regard to its participation in the emergence of culture, I'm very modest. You should not lay claims to things which we have not contributed anything to. But however, with regard to matters that we have actually proclaimed to the world, ideas which we have actually advised the world about their existence, so you should take pride in it. And this is one of the ideas that Judaism gave to the world. Answering the question which intrigued the finest mind, namely, what is man, the Bible said. And you look at me in surprise if I'll tell you. Man is a lonely being. And in this feeling of loneliness, the distinctness of man manifests itself. The first distinctive element in man, which sets men apart from nature or from creation in general, is his solitude. Call it loneliness, call it aloofness, but his solitude, his separateness. Why is he lonely? Because, that's what Judaism will answer. And I'll show you the law answer this. Each man is not only a single individual, this is not well formulated, but also a singular being. Not a single being, but a singular being. And right here is one of the reasons why Judaism could not accept the individualistic theory of man. Although Judaism believes in the individual, because the individualistic theory of man did not speak of singular beings, but of single beings. Like atoms within physical matter. So it means each being equal to another. Like two atoms. Each atom, within the particular, element, they equal each other. Like two electrons, the subatomic structure. Or two neutrons, they equal each other. All right, okay, in the emergence of society, they said, the atom came first, concrete matter later. Concrete matter of society is a coalescence basically of atoms, of individual atoms. But the individual is only an atom. They are all identical. The same attitude, the same creative talent, the same experiences. It is the same existential experience that's important. The same antic awareness. It is just atoms many. Of course, they were very gracious to say that individual is responsible for the society, not the society, for the individual. But the individual itself is just one of many, or one among many. And there are many like him. There's almost an infinite number like him, like there's an infinite number of atoms. It's just atomization of society. But atomization of society does not mean restoration of the dignity of the individual. Because in order to be a dignified being, it's not enough if I say I am responsible for society. But now we don't care for you. Because if you are not here, someone else will fill the void. Someone else will replace you, will supplant. Because the same abilities. That's exactly what the question is. Is it just a single individual? That's what the individualistic theory says. That's what Rousseau and all of them say. It's a single individual. And basically, when you read carefully the Declaration of Independence, and then Jefferson, there is no singularity of the individual. He speaks about the dignity of the individual created in the image of man. And of course, and ascribe the so-called the legis natura, the natural rights which are inherent in the individual. Yes, but individual to them is replaceable, is dispensable. It's not Mr. X, it's Mr. Y. And it's not Mr. Y, it's Mr. Z. Judaism's greatness in this regard was, it said the individual is not only a single being, it is a singular being. Let us continue. God created man, and I'll show you how Judaism arrived at that. It was not just a caprice on the part of Judaism. God created man in his image. B'Tselem Elokim Bara Eisam. And the divine aspect of man expresses itself not so much in his intellect, I mean, the intellect of man is a bit naive, but rather spiritual and mental capabilities or attitudes which the human being possesses in contradistinction to the animal and the plant, but in his very existential experience of aloneness. It's better to say, later we'll see what's the difference between loneliness and aloneness. It's better to say that the image of God expresses itself in the fact that man is lonely or solitary, in his aloneness and otherness, in his estrangement and separateness from creation in general and from the Tao in particular. Man is lonely with regard to two. He is lonely with regard to the forest, if I should find myself in the forest, or some in the woods, or in the fields. I am lonely among the trees. I am lonely among the animals. I am lonely in the jungle. Correct? This means the loneliness, which is estrangement of man from creation in general. There is also another concept of loneliness of man and experience at the social level. Man is lonely not only with regard to the forest and to the trees and to the animals, or to the ocean and to this, but to the heavens. He is also lonely with regard to the Tao. If I find myself at Times Square and I am a stranger, I also experience loneliness. But it's not loneliness, I mean, which makes me so feel my estrangement from nature, but makes me conscious of my, so to say, of the gap or the gulf dividing me from the crowd. Why is it? So let's not forget that Judaism is a monotheistic religion. We all know that. Our basic article of faith found expression in the opening verse to Shema. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. The word in Hebrew for one is Echad. You know what? Basically, in Hebrew, Echad means not only one. Echad in Hebrew, we don't know, has the feeling for the semantic aspect of Echad, and it's a Hebrew word, means not only one, but it means the only one. Not only one, but the only one. So basically, there would be two translations of Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. We would translate it not, Hear, O Israel, God is our, the Lord is our God. The Lord is one, but I would say, the Lord is our God, the Lord is the only one. And of course, you can make a mathematical equation. Only one equals the lonely one. So actually, if you want to translate Shema Israel in English, and promise and translate properly, it would be, Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is lonely. Strange, but this one. Because Echad means not only the Lord is one, but is unique, is the only one, is singular, has no friend, has no associate. Basically, Ibn Ezra, the medieval commentator of the Bible, says so. He says the verse in the sense, God being alone, not one, but alone. Even the German Jewish scholar, one of the fathers of liberal Judaism, Tunes, Leopold Tunes, also translated this verse, not only as one, but also as unique. God is unique. It means lonely. What does it mean, God is lonely? God is different from all other beings. He is only other than all creatures. His existence is singular. and incommensurable with our existential experience.
This means, what do you mean, lonely, only one?
His existence is different from ours. In the Maimonidean philosophy, the Echad, as implying, if I may use a term, a theological term introduced by Otto, the German author, the Numen. The Numen means the unknowability, the strangeness, the otherness. Something which is different, something which is incommensurable, incongruous with whatever I know and I experience. The Numen, the unique, incomprehensible, incommunicable, and inexpressible existence. To my mind, this incommunicability of that existence to others, his uniqueness, his unknowability, his loneliness, his aloneness, sound the keynote of all philosophical thinking in Judaism. All according to Maimonides, all we may predicate of God according to Maimonides is his incomparability with creation and his unknowability. This is the only attribute what you can say. What you can say about God is he's not like us. Can't see anything positive. And if you know the famous doctrine of Maimonides, many call it the docta ignorantia, or negative theology, whether these terms are true is a different problem, but it means we all can know about God that he is different from us. Now if you just, you have, there, is there the guide here? You have the guide? If you just be so kind and open the guide, first section, and chapter 60, first section, Attributes of God, page 88. I don't want you to believe me as my mind says so. I mean, you'll just check. Page 88. Fourth line, page 88. For it has been shown that every perfection we could imagine, even if existing in God, in accordance with the opinion of those who assert the existence of attributes, would in reality not be of the same kind as that imagined by us, but would only be called by the same name according to our explanation. It would in fact amount to negation. When you say God exists, and you want to subsume existence, our category of existence, it's a wrong statement. You can only say God exists not the way we exist. Nothing else. Or rather, if we should employ a Maimonidean phrase, he does not exist the way we exist. Negate. Yes. Now, suppose we can skip that. You thus necessarily arrive at some negation without obtaining a true conception of an essential attribute. On the contrary, you are led to assume that there is a plurality in God and to believe that he is all one essence has several unknown attributes. For if you intend to affirm them, you cannot compare them with those attributes known by us, and they are consequently not of the same kind. You are, as it were, brought by the belief in the reality of attributes to say that God is one subject of which several things are predicated, though the subject is not like ordinary subjects, and the predicates are not like ordinary predicates, and so forth. So my mind is the whole chapter 60 and 61 wants to show one thing. All you can say about God, that he is not like us. So what does it mean in other words? If one is not like us, so what is it? In simple English, he's alone. Because if he's like us, he's not alone. If there is commensurability, there is something a common denominator. There is something universal in both of us. It's not alone. There is nothing in common between God and creation. Now, Judaism, as a matter of fact, also spoke of God as the lonely being, abiding in seclusion, hidden in his infinite recesses, and a solitary being. And this is, when you want to say a solitary being, Or the only one, you can say instead of echod, you say yachid. Yachid means already not one. Although echod itself involves this only one, but yachid means the only one. And we have a passage in the Bible, in the Pentateuch. We have the English translation?
Yes,
yeah, but I'll first find it in the Bible. Well, here. Yes. It is, would you be so kind and take? It is Deuteronomy 32:12. Deuteronomy 32:12. Adishem Badat Yanchenu, Veinimo Kilecho. The translation is a very poor one. It says, God so the Lord alone did lead him, and there was no strange God with him. But Badat is more, Badat is alone, not in the sense no one helps him, but he is alone. Not in the sense no one helped him. Because if we had expressed this, it would take Adishem Levadoi Yanchenu. But here is Badat. God, the lonely God. That is in translation. God, the lonely God. Badat, Badat is loneliness. God, the lonely God. The lonely God lead him, and there was no strange God with him. God, the Lord, the lonely Lord, the lonely one. God is always enveloped in a cloud. Cloud of darkness. Clouds and darkness are about him. This identification, God with the cloud, is very familiar to everybody who knows the Bible. Vayered Hashem Ba'anan, God has descended, enveloped in a cloud. Let us take, for instance, the Psalms 97, if I'm not mistaken. 97, the Psalms. Cloud and darkness are round about him. I mean, there is, I believe, a passage like that, a verse like that. 97.
You say it every Friday.
One of our authors. Loneliness of God. 97, you heard?
Is that 97?
Yes. Oh no, second verse. One of our authors. Cloud and darkness are around about him, correct?
Yes.
What does it mean, loneliness? It is always the cloud as a symbol of isolation, aloofness, solitude, seclusion, withdrawal. Loneliness of God is perhaps the highest term of Judaic theological thinking. Why is it the highest term? Because it has a tremendous influence over our social philosophy. If God weren't lonely, we couldn't have developed this beautiful social philosophy we did develop. Since man was created in the image of God, his specific endowment consists in his existential loneliness. And I'll explain later what it means, which is an expression of his uniqueness and separateness from being as a whole. And modern psychology and psychiatry, many, have erred in their interpretation of the feeling of loneliness. It's a basic mistake. Of course, this mistake has penetrated lately theological thinking, and all pastoral psychologists, that means who a rabbi is not a psychologist, or a theologian is not a psychologist, or the other way around. A psychologist who is neither a rabbi nor a theologian. So this combination is a very funny one. When they speak about integrating men into society, coalescing him, and simply trying men to help him, he should rid himself of feeling of loneliness, solitude, I mean, he is making a basic mistake. Of course, it is not always, loneliness is not always a disintegrative and devastating emotion. I say not always, sometimes yes. Later will come when loneliness becomes a disintegrative or a disjunctive emotion, what do you call it, or a devastating emotion. Not always is it a negative emotion indicating disturbance or frustrating experiences. Only at certain times, loneliness is engendered by mental desolation and forlornness, and is indicative of a sick soul, yes, at certain times. Yet, loneliness is not only to be found in the area of morbid self-introspection, of unfounded fears, inferiority, self-loathing, and debasing, or self-contempt, but also, and perhaps mainly, in a new dimension, in depth of human greatness, in human dignity and glory. Man is great and glorious because he is lonely. When the psalmist exclaims, "For thou hast made him," 8, if you don't mind, Psalm 8. Psalm 8. You'll hear it. "For thou hast made him." A little lower than the angels, yes, yeah? Do you have it? "For thou hast made him a little lower than the angels," yes? It says, what verse is it? Huh? 6, yes. "For thou hast made him a little lower than the angels." Again, angels said the translation. "Vat chatzreyu me'at melekim," does that mean angels? Sometimes the Bible, elekim, is a substitute for angel, for malach. But basically, only elekim means than God. You just made him a bit lower than God. "And has crowned him with glory and honor." Yes. So what does it mean, a bit lower than God? It's not with regard to our capabilities. As far as our capabilities are concerned, we are not just a bit lower than God. We're very far removed from God. When he speaks about a bit lower from God, he refers to the existential experience of man. And he refers to the unique gift which was bestowed upon man, namely his loneliness, his solitude. Of course, the feeling of solitude is a painful one, no doubt about it. Sweet man comes, through loneliness perhaps, man comes close to the reality of suffering. No doubt about it. I don't say it's a very comfortable feeling. It's a painful feeling. However, this necessity of coming close to the reality of suffering is also an opportunity to share in the travail of an inspired existence. And who knows whether one can share in the great drama of existence without subjecting oneself to pain or to suffering. Now, let us see. God is lonely. Man is lonely. Conclusion is one, is very simple. What is the conclusion? That man draws toward God, and God searches forward toward man. Two lonely beings meet each other. Basically, the meeting, the rendezvous between man and God, because both are lonely. And how beautiful, I mean, Plotinus, or is it, not the Jewish philosopher. Beautiful. You find it in Psalm. What is actually religious experience? If not the flight of the lonely to the lonely one. There's only one difference. The first L in lonely is small, and the lonely one are capitalized. But this is true from a Judaic viewpoint. The first approach of man to God and God's moving from his transcendence toward man manifests the paradoxical mutual fascination. The lonely finite being and the lonely infinite being are subjected to. Man searches toward God because he is lonely, abandoned by creation, as such, forlorn in his seclusion and aloneness, and in order to allay his painful experience and to help or to heal his tormented mind and tortured heart, and to restore them to the health of serenity and of an existence of fellowship, and God, who is lonely, meet. Because one experience combines them both. This is the strange existential experience of solitude, to which man, is easier paradoxically to escape, in which we find the thread of an existence dedicated to some ultimate end woven in the fabric of one's personality. It's both. He wants to escape it, and he's great because of this experience. Now, particular attention
should be devoted to the nature of prayer, Mr. Dahl. What is prayer? If Judaism didn't know the concept of loneliness, Judaism could not develop the idea of prayer. Now, let's know, prayer as such is a Judaic concept. The Greeks didn't understand what prayer was.
So then prayer was more singing an aesthetic hymn.
Oh, to me.
If you see something nice, you write a note.
What the ode, to me?
Ode in Horace. It's nothing but the ode. But the ode is not a prayer. Because basically you know very well that so-called hymn plays a minor role in Jewish prayer. The so-called extolling hymn, or even the thanksgiving hymn, plays a minor role. What is the very core of prayer? It is so-called intercessory prayer, or the petition. What many call it, because of ignorance, the selfish prayer, when I ask God to gratify my needs. But in Judaism, because intercessory prayer is indicative of man's crisis, of man's distress. The hymn is not indicative of distress, of crisis. Because prayer in Judaism is combined, knitted very closely with tzara. Tzara means distress, when one finds himself in straits, in narrow straits. Yes, one said, I mean, when I come to Eretz Israel, I forget all my tzaras, but I found tzarot. What does tzara mean? Tzara means not calamity, I want you to understand. This is, again, a mistaken translation. It's not calamity, it's not catastrophe. Tzara is tzar. Tzara means narrow. When one finds himself in narrow straits, mina meitzar karatika, from the narrow straits, out of the narrow, or de profundis, when I find myself somewhere in the depths, I can't. It means when man is in crisis, basically it's crisis. It is distress, but not the selfish distress. It is depth distress. Distress in being itself. And this exactly drives man to God, drives him to pray. That's why the hymn, we have the hymn, we have psalms and many hymns, but basically 75% of all the psalms is God answer. Answer my petition, I will follow him. I mean, as a matter of fact, in the recommended reading, I wanted you to read, I mean, these psalms, in which the distress comes to expression. You're letting the psalm, I mean, the book of psalms, any psalm, distress. I am lowly, I am poor, the people, I mean, I'm forlorn, I'm on the brink of nihility, I'm at the brink of hell, I mean, I can't find myself, help me find myself, I'm trying to escape my fate, my destiny. I mean, this is the motif, this is exactly loneliness. If not for long, that's why Judaism has emphasized, stressed, underlined the intercessory prayer, or the so-called petition, and or the selfish prayer, as it's called by some theologians. You take a Shemoneh Esrei, which is composed of not 18, 19, so you have only six hymns, actually you have only a few, which deal with singing a hymn to God. But mostly, it's simply, I specify my needs. And at the end I say, I cannot specify my needs, you know my needs better than I do, so please answer. Particular attention should be devoted to the nature of prayer, one of the most exalted religious experiences. Prayer basically is a dialogue between God and single man, an encounter between a lonely soul and its lonely creator. It's only a dialogue between two people, a duologue. It's not a symposium prayer. So if the community comes to God, then it is a symposium. It's more than a dialogue, I would say. And prayer is only a dialogue, a duologue, a dusich. Only between two. Who is the two? On the one hand is the one, yes. But on the other hand, who comes before God? Not the community. We have communal prayer too. But basically the Jewish prayer, not the communal prayer, and this is individual prayer. And this is one of the basic mistakes. Which, for instance, not that I'm criticizing, but it's a fact that liberal Judaism has made by eliminating the individual prayer and individual approach. It's just communal singing, communal participation. Yes, no one is lonely. No one is lonely. I feel very comfortable. Particularly the type of temples they're building now, the million-dollar temples. I don't believe the lonely soul can... He's already comforted by the beautiful picture.
And he's proud? Is it?
Dwelling comes to expression in the basic desire of men. Basically, prayer...
I want to depart for a while from the concept of individual versus community, and just in order to show that prayer is based on loneliness individual. Basically, prayer expresses a certain needy man.
And if I should employ a biblical metaphor, this need, I would say, expresses itself in what Isaiah said, Ki litichra kol derech tishova kol ashe. Surely unto me every knee shall bow, and every tongue shall swear allegiance. We have it in our Kine Kavala Chatur. Every knee should bow. Why should every knee bow? What does kneeling mean? Kneeling is also one of the symbols in religious life, how one expresses it. Not even mental fatigue, what we call ontic fatigue of being, of metaphysical exhaustion, not psychological exhaustion, metaphysical exhaustion, of disgust with life and with everything it has to offer to man. This is prayer. Prayer is self-abandoning and complete surrender. And in this very act of surrendering, tired man finds solace and quietude. And Freud again. Freud erred here. It's a basic error in Freud. He considers, when he speaks of the infantilism involved in the religious experience. On the one hand, he was right when he says that religion has the element of fatherhood, the child running to the father. He's right. I wouldn't say this is the entire religious experience. It's one of the aspects of the religious experience. But there is one of the basic aspects. We run to God as a little child who finds himself in distress or in trouble, wants his father, he should help him.
Yes, that's correct. The child who is incapable of solving his own problems wants his father, who is supposed to accomplish what the youngster cannot do.
Yes, he's right in there. I wouldn't argue with him. But he's wrong if he thinks that this is infantile. That the need for casting off anguish and sorrow in the lap of God, the Father, is far from a neurotic attitude or infantile attitude on the part of frightened man. It is instead a very healthy response, sometimes, to crushing defeat and crisis. The feeling of insecurity ends many a time when security is found in the lonely down. And it's interesting, if you want to take a look, Psalm 55, chapter 55, verse 23. Hashkaich ala deshem miyahavcha, v'huyichal kalaka. Cast thy burden upon the Lord, and he shall sustain thee. Cast thy burden, 55, verse 23. Cast thy burden upon the Lord, and he shall sustain thee. Will you be so kind and read in the following verse? I don't have it in my manuscript, the following verse. In English, what's the following verse? Will you be so kind, 23? He will never suffer the righteous to be moved.
Below you can all
yes. The lonely person comes before God. Man in despair and fear kneels before him and hides his head, bent under the heavy yoke of living. And he, at his bosom, men whom everybody has forsaken and betrayed find shelter in God. Prayer means a feeling of being forsaken by everybody. No one understands me, not because of the fault of, and not because the other fellow is wrong, not of any culpability on the part of any fellow. No, I don't blame anybody. I don't indict anybody because he can't understand me. Why? Because he's lonely and he's like, I am lonely. How can two lonely beings understand each other? How come later to be such pleasure? But that's why the individual is forsaken. It's not an indictment. Men whom everybody has forsaken and betrayed find shelter in God. Men who forfeited everything, friendship, sympathy, and understanding on the part of others. In a word, lonely man clings to him. And this means, every knee bows before thee, because every knee must lose its arrogance and security at one time or another. Now, if you'll be so kind, you open the psalm again. Psalm 27, verses 9 and 10. And you read it, you'll see what prayer means. 27, Le David Ori. As a matter of fact, recited the whole month of Elul until after Shemini Atzeret. Verse 9 and 10. Hide not thy face from me. Put not thy servant away in anger. Thou hast been my help. Cast me not off. Neither forsake me, O God of my salvation. For though my father and my mother have forsaken me, the Lord will take me up. Father and mother have forsaken me. And we'll see later, it is true. It's not just a claim. It is true. I mean, it appears strange how father and mother can forsake a child. We'll see about it later. This exactly. And that is why, and please, I'm not, please don't have me wrong, I'm not trying to preach an orthodoxy. But, I mean, now it's by the sheer force of associative thinking, I have to mention it. That's why we offer Jews our post to mix to the family pew in the synagogue. So the family pew, you know why the family pew is wrong? Why that, if I ask you why the family pew is wrong, according to our thinking, I'll ask, why do people want to have a family pew? Why does the American Jew want to pray together with his wife and children? He wants to feel comfortable. Comfortable. So he takes a look at his wife. She is a beacon of light to him, a fortress of strength. The children, they wouldn't desert him. They wouldn't forsake him. They, whenever in need, whenever he'll be in need, he can come to his wife and children. That's exactly what David, the psalmist, wants us not to believe. That's why we fight against the family pew, because we want to isolate the individual from the family, at least for an hour or two. And to come to God, or before God, as a lonely individual, has no family, no wife, no children, no parents. You know that basically we never allow child and father to stay to sit next to each other. Because the child takes a look at his father, when he has trouble, he'll come to his finite father. So there is, and the basic element in prayer, the conditio sine qua non of prayer is this sentence, this verse in the psalm, ki avi v'imi yazavui, father and mother, best friend, the staunchest friend of a man, have forsaken me. And this should be not only, of course, it's a mental experience, but it's a mental experience, we have to create environment for it, the climate for it. It's a very soft seed, and I have my wife and children around me, and if I say it, I seem to say a lie. This is exactly the basic philosophy why you oppose. I mean, a lot of nonsense has been said about us. We're opposed to the fair sex. It's ridiculous. Ooh, if one knows what the status of a woman is in the halakha, they cannot say it. Such statements come from people either who are ignorant, simply they don't know what the station of the woman was in the halakha, or they're not ignorant, but they simply distort facts. Of course, it's a very daring indictment, but I have to say, it has nothing to do with the question of sex. It has to do with the problem of family view. No family in the synagogue. In the synagogue, not a family comes, not a community comes. There is no community in the synagogue either. It's nothing. They're isolated individuals, but still, yes, you need a place for to worship. So there is physical contiguity, so to say, in space. But mentally, each one is a world itself. And he looks upon the other one as a stranger. Not as my neighbor, as my friend, as a stranger. As a one who is completely indifferent to my suffering, to my problems, to the doubts which have filled my mind. Who is completely absolute, there's no concern for me. And there's only one friend I come to. This is God, the Lord will take me out. Now, let's go to you. The humanitas of man culminates in his loneliness. The latter is not, as a rule, a devastating, but an ennobling experience, the absence of which shuts out the vision of God from one's life.
And that's exactly what is wrong with the basic philosophy of peace of mind as an aim in religion. At least Judaism. I have no right to speak about religion in general. And Judaism. Of course, I see now sociologists begin to attack this problem, philosophers, but basically it's wrong that peace of mind means complete forgetting about one Christ. It means a belief that I am fully successful. Successful at the highest level. And I saw many fools who think they are successful in life. That men cannot be defeated. That he didn't suffer any defeat. And of course, they measured success and defeat in terms, in very shallow terms. And making money on this and that. Social station, I mean, social prominence, I mean, and so forth. I mean, which is something that's similar to this. Cannot be. Then there's no need for that. At least the need is a secondary one. The flight, as Plotinus said, of the lonely to the lonely one, can come out of distress. And we Jews believe that there are two kinds of distress, two kinds of crisis. One crisis we call the surface crisis. Surface crisis. For instance, disease, famine, war, poverty, it's a surface crisis. Because it does not touch the very existence of man, I mean his experience as an existent, as a person. It's because it's due to certain environmental conditions. I mean, and these conditions can be alleviated, can change. I'm hungry, tomorrow I can have money and buy bread. Today I'm sick, tomorrow I'll recover. And so forth on. I mean, this is surface crisis. Surface crisis, of course, also. I mean, a man who finds himself in this typical crisis, I mean, runs to God. But Judaism said there is permanent sorrow. There is a permanent sorrow. There is a permanent, man finds himself in permanent distress. Permanent distress. And this is not just due to his environment, due to certain conditions. It is because his very being is in distress. And no one can help him. While, for instance, certain crises can be understood by others. If I am sick, people express sympathy. When someone is hungry, people will extend help to him. But there is a certain crisis of distress within man, not on the outside, to which man is, so to say, subjected, but within man, which no one understands. It is the impossibility of attaining complete success. It is the necessity for defeat from time to time. It is the necessity to share the reality of pain. I don't mean physical pain. It is, and this distress, this permanent distress, state of distress, prevails as long as man is man. Because man's humanitas, man's, so to say, singularity expresses itself. And one of the basic aspects of this permanent distress is the aloneness of man. And here comes prayer. If you want to alleviate, come to God. But of course, it can never be alleviated completely. And I'll show you how it expresses itself in the Allah. And then see, whoever does not feel himself and feel that he is in distress, in this permanent distress, experiencing distress, experiencing incompleteness, experiencing, so to say, I mean, the crisis.
He can never meet God. The vision of God is shut out of his world. Only the lonely person, always in distress. Take for instance, Judaism has formulated the aspects of this inner distress and permanent distress, what they are. But it's not a time, just on the Psalms, yes? I have to check. Excuse me for a moment. Yes. Will you be so kind and look up Psalm 130. 130. The famous Psalm, De Profundis. Just the first. Could you give me the English text? Yes, will you be so kind? 130, yes. Out of the depths have I called thee, O Lord, De Profundis. What does it mean, out of the depths? What kind of depth does he speak? What kind of depth? How do we find ourselves in depths? In my distress I called unto the Lord, and he answered me. O Lord, deliver my soul from lying lips, from a deceitful tongue. What shall be given unto thee, and what shall be done more unto thee, thou deceitful tongue? Sharp arrows of the mighty, his calls have room. What does it mean, out of my distress? And what is distress? He doesn't specify anything here. Sickness, hunger, war. What is distress? The lying tongues, the lying lips, and the deceitful tongue. Who is lying? Who is lying? Where did he see liars around himself, David? Are there so many liars in the world? Everybody's a liar. Oh, Lord, I'm crazy. Why is he a liar? Because when he displays sympathy for the Tao, he basically does not feel the Tao. The Tao is not real to him. Is the Tao real to him? When we come to express our condolences in case of death, when we come to visit the sick, is the Tao real to me? As a rabbi, I do many. I visit the sick, and of course, I pay many visits of condolence. So is the distress of the other fellow real to me? It's not real to me. Then I say, I'm sorry, and I have sympathy. It's lying lips. It's a deceitful tongue. Because the seat is a part of man because he's lonely. There's no understanding on the part of the other one. And this is the permanent distress in which man finds himself. And of course, the more mother man becomes, the smoother he talks, the richer his vocabulary is, and the easier he can roll off sentences, the bigger a liar he is, of course. The Lord deliver me, my soul, and there's no indictment of other, because I am the same liar as he is. Because I am lonely, he is lonely, and there is nothing about it. This is the basic element which is overlooked in modern prayer. The basic element. Yes, sir.
Why is dominion required? Is prayer a question of the individual being alone?
You know for what dominion is required? Logically, for the saying of the Kaddish and for the recital of the Kedusha. This means for the hymn, but not for the intercessory prayer. The singing of what is Kaddish? Kaddish means the singing of the hymn. The hymn, glorified and exalted be his name, or Kadosh, 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 Sanctum, Sanctum, Sanctum. This is the hymn, for the hymn, but not for the intercessory prayer. The hymn, of course, thanksgiving, these glorious tones of hymnal music, is much nicer than the religious community. But when man comes to surrender, so hide his head in the lap of God and say, everybody betrayed me. Even father and mother have forsaken me. You are my only friend I have because you are Lord in my life. We understand each other. There is no meaning required.
The tradition of son not following father as an aliyah, that follows what you said before
about father? No, it's a different reason. The reason is because whoever is called up for the aliyah testifies that the Torah is good. And the law is that two relatives are disqualified from testifying. So if you call out the father and the son,
so they cannot testify. Because according to Jewish law, two witnesses must testify in order to confirm something. The testimony of one witness is not enough. So when you call out the first one and the second one, so both testify. Torah temet. It's a true Torah. But father and son can never testify together. This is the reason. Because Kriyas HaTorah is not prayer, I want you to tell you. It's a star, it's not prayer. It's at least at a different level. Kriyas HaTorah is basic study. I mean, there is a combination of prayer and study, it's a different level.
Where is your evidence about father and son not praying together?
In Ramoh, in Isalis, in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Kol, he said that one should not embrace the child, or even pet his child, or even look at his child, caress his child with a glance during prayer, because it should be because everybody is forsaken except that. It's simple, clear, cut law in the court. I don't remember now the paragraph, but next time I'll give you. I'll write you a letter. I'll be.
I was just wondering, in terms of prayer is, in the prayer book, it can be very stock. Everyone, I mean, everyone can say the word.
Correct. The question of standardized prayer.
Yeah. I'm just wondering, they're saying the friends, where there's the silence of prayer. In terms
yeah, I know. The silence of prayer among the players. I mean, we know, basically, I want you to understand. I mean, we are getting away from our topic. Basically, prayer is what we call, in the Halakhic terminology, avodah shebalev. It is service by the heart. This, so to say, this physical act of pronouncing words is more a medium, a techne, than the very act of prayer. Why standardized prayer was introduced is my mind is explained, because simple people don't know how to express it. And in order to make prayer democratic, there was an element of democracy, as my mind is explained. For the man, the literate person, could have said beautiful prayer. This was before Ezra, before the Great Assembly. The person who is a stutterer, but the man has no language, the primitive person couldn't pray. So in order to as I tell you, Judaism is also an institutionalized religion. As an institutionalized religion, it has to reckon with the needs of the matter. And you cannot keep something at a lofty level and simply bar the matter from participating. That's why prayer has been standardized. But the experience of prayer has never been standardized. It shouldn't be standardized.
Well, if that is so, certainly the prayers that are recited are foreign in terms of our tongue today.
What do you mean tongue? You mean terms of language?
Yes.
You mean language simply because it's Hebrew and English?
That's right, the kind of translation.
Yeah, I'll tell you, I mean, basically prayer can be recited in every language, you know, that if the text is there. It's law. Yes, prayer can be, the basic law is that prayer can be recited in every language which a person speaks. However, I mean, I would recommend that people should study prayers in Hebrew, because there it's very hard to translate something well. I showed you Echod. Echod has not been translated well. Oh, but that is lonely, I mean, it's hard to translate. There is no genuine translation for anything.
But, why shouldn't you accept the translation, the Lord, our God, the Lord is one, instead of saying the Lord is our God, the Lord is one? Which would you accept as the more likely apt translation?
I would agree, I've never thought about it, but I would agree more that the Elohim is a qualifying, is a clause. It means the Lord our God.
The Lord our God.
Yeah. As a clause in comma. I would put it in comma. As a clause. I would put it as a clause. Yes, sir.
The concept that you give of the Torah.
Yes.
Which is for a moment it sounds at first blush anti-psychological in the sense that it is an unchanging, immutable Torah that responds not to changes of social conditions.
No, I wouldn't say that it's immutable or unchangeable outright. Of course, for instance, the way I experience it is dependent upon the general cultural constellation and my position within society, of course. But all you say that everybody must experience incompleteness in itself. Incompleteness and also failure. Defeat at a certain level. But the levels change, and the terms of the experiential terms in which I may interpret it
Certainly, subject to cultural changes. But I say you can never, so to say, redeem yourself from this. It is permanent, it cannot be. But let me speak about Lawless. If I may just... Now, let us see what is loneliness, basically. What is loneliness? We spoke about it, but still we didn't define it. You know very well that only man is lonely. The lion, the horse, or the cat is not lonely. You know this very well. It's hard to say, but let's assume so. As much as the humane society is trying to tell us what is humane, what or that is inhumane. I've asked one of the readers, did he interview the animal? How does he know animal? Anyway, but it is, of course, it is an inseparable part, as I said, of our existential awareness. What all about it? Let us see. And please, I would ask you to pay attention. I begin to bore now. I'm becoming a bore. But for a while, just for a short while. While the whole universe shares only surface existence with man, only surface existence, the human being lays claim to a depth existence as well. And I'll explain. The three attributes, for instance, reality, the certain object, the particular object, such as a stone in the inanimate world, or the animal in the organic zoological kingdom, or to this mic, or to this glass, or to this book. We say the stone exists. What do you understand by saying the stone exists? Or this glass of water is real, or this book is real. So all we say is, it exists at a behavioral level only, or insofar as this object is affected or and by and affecting change in others. It means this object can be affected by some action or can also affect action in others. It means in terms of causality. The stone exists and its reality is equal. If you ask, what does the reality of the stone equal, the mathematical equation, what will you say? The sum total of mass and energy, that's all. Right? You'll open up a book of physics and you'll say, the sum total of mass and energy. Of course, is equal the behavioral sum total or its position within the causal nexus. It exists as much as much action we can ascribe to it. Whatever the stone is betrayed and expressed by its activity. It exists outside, on the surface, because it may affect changes in other objects. It may also be affected by the impact of other objects. And of course, the fact that it is affected, this book, these objects affected, it affects changes in another object, because it's really, the causal nexus is a continuous one, and it changes here, and it involves the change there. It exists outside on the surface, expressed in mathematical equations of mass and energy. There is no existence to be attributed to the stone other than one manifested in its causal relational behavior, in its activity. Of course, I cannot say activity of a stone, but in its effectiveness. Whatever the stone is, its whole existence is exhausted by its relatedness to others. The stone alone doesn't exist, you know. It exists as a cause and an effect within the whole of the cosmic drama. And this is true not only of the stone in the book, it's true of the stars and the suns of animate and inanimate nature. Therefore, to make scientific observations of things, of dead things, or even of animals, but particularly of dead things, is epistemologically a simple task. Of course, it might be associated with technical difficulties, particularly at the microcosmic level, but there is one thing which is true. The stone doesn't lie, does it? Or the animal doesn't lie if the stone is interviewed I mean interview not in the sense of a dialogue, but I mean an interview in the laboratory, under the microscope or wherever it is. He doesn't lie. Whatever the scientist observes is true. And this is why the natural scientists are so fortunate that they can predict with exactness the behavior of the stars and the moon and of the stone and of the drop of water for a simple reason, because those objects don't lie. And why don't they lie? What is lying mean? Lying means my behavior is something else and my within existence is not commensurable with my within existence. There is no within existence in the stone. Whatever it is expressed to others, you see. Nothing hidden in the thing, nothing is hidden in the thing itself, beyond its behavioral surface. There are no indentations in the stone, indentations, or abstruse corners. No secret, nothing. There is sometimes secret in matter, but finally we get out of it. And how do you get out? We observe, I mean, the behavior of matter. How do we get out? Do we get out, I mean, the secret of the subatomic structure? By a beam of light. For instance, an atom gets off the orbit, there is an optical effect. And this is true, because the atom would not light us. However, many different. He certainly exists like other things, of course. And we can understand man by his behavior. Certainly. Within which he finds himself on par with other things, or with the concrete order, within which he finds himself placed. Namely, on the outside. He also lives on the outside. We live through our talking. How do people know of us? Because of our speech, of our actions, of our reactions, responses, of our endeavors, and so forth. And yes, for one may also equate human existence with his deportment, right? And dismiss the other existential aspects completely. As a matter of fact, I am not speaking so straight through my head. As a matter of fact, many psychologists have done so and have eo ipso, and they've equated man with his behavior. And the whole psychology of behaviorism is that. So the psychology of, what do you call it, of association? Spencer, Stuart Mill, all of them, in particular in America, the behaviorism. So what does the psychology of behaviorism say? What is man? The sum total of his activity. So it means man is an outside existence. He has no within existence, or perhaps he has, but we are not interested. I mean, say the way they did that.
But that's all. But of course, by this statement, they destroy the very concept of the human personality in its unique station within the realm of things. We, advocates of religious anthropology, in particular of Judaism, important there, where Judaism was great, revolutionary, know that there is more to man than his instinctive behavior betrays.
There is more to man than his actions tell us. There is nothing more to the stone than his behavior. There is more to man than his behavior. There is more to man than his work. Man is greater than his work. While the stone is not greater than his activity.
This strange being possesses not only surface, but also depth of existence. Inwardness,
or I would say within-centeredness, a within-centeredness,
or self-containment, self-concentration, which does never express itself through automatic compulsive activity that is limited to the outside. There is always more to personality than its active participation in the order of things or its active contribution to society. There is more to personality. The causal relational order encompasses man, yes, as well as other existences, animal, plant, and mineral. Yet while the latter, animal, plant, and mineral, are confined, the latter is confined to this series, and everything in them is poured into their functioning, man transcends this realm of mechanical existence, the realm of functionality, and he's not only a member of a comprehensive dynamic system, like the animal, but he also finds his reality in immanence, in selfhood, in being rooted to within, in personal collects and riches, in an existence which cannot be exhausted in action, nor in behavior,
or nor in surface manifestation. There is always, you cannot say, man equals his activity. Man equals his behavior. It's a false equation. Never mind about any metaphysics. It's a false equation. Man is always greater than his work. His thought, it is really a creative being. It's interesting, the saying, the Midrashic saying, when Moses wrote the Torah, so some ink remained in the pen. So he wiped the pen on his forehead, and that's why his face began to be, so Moses' face being. What does it mean? Moshe could not express himself ever. There is more to Moses than his work. And for instance, you know, this the playwright, the famous Scandinavian playwright, Danish playwright, Ibsen, and there is the famous drama, Architect Solness, if I believe that I am quoting correctly, Architect Solness. In America, Ibsen was never apparently in the vogue. It was in Europe, I mean, in Western Europe, there were times which were simply completely dominated by Ibsen. And now with the rising tide of existentialism in America, Ibsen should come back, should be written into life, I mean, probably it will. So there is Architect Solness. Ibsen describes an architect. Ibsen's people in general are very weak people, weak. Not great characters. I mean, particularly men. The women are much stronger, more possessive and domineering than men. I don't know, probably due to his childhood experiences, mother and father, I don't know exactly. I don't. So in Architect Solness, Ibsen describes a great architect, a genius, who used to build all the churches, particularly the Gothic architecture. The Gothic architecture expresses men's desire for infinity, men's surging upward. I mean, men's this demonic gesture to encompass the universe, right, to get into heaven. This is basically the Gothic architecture. So what I mean, actually, Spengler or whatever, interpreted this way. So he was a genius in designing such churches with the spiral and towers and so forth. But he never dared to climb the tower he built. When he began to climb the tower he built, any tower he built, the beautiful tower, he used to get dizzy. So finally some woman persuaded him. This was filmed, huh? Architect Solness still happened this. There is no fabula to it. There's no fabula. I can understand how Ibsen can lend itself to Hollywood. I don't know. Anyway, perhaps. So finally one woman, a strong woman, he convinces him to climb the church he built. And he climbs up to the bell tower and gets dizzy, falls down and dies. What did Ibsen want to express? That the works of men are greater than his. Because he could design beautiful towers, he could never scale the height, which his works have to attain. And this is what Judaism says it's for. If one is an architect, so he's greater than his design. This is exactly what Judaism would violently disagree. The creator is always greater than his creation. And again, because man was created in the image of God. And what is greater, God than his creation, than the universe? Of course, God is greater. And man is created in the image of God. So man is greater than it. If this architect, particular architect, can build such towers, and shooting forth into heaven, he can scale it. Otherwise, it wouldn't have been able to do. There's more to it. It's exactly what the Midrash said about Moses. He was greater than his pen. His pen is outside existence.
Oh, yes.
Of course, this unique existence cannot be just observed. This unique existence, the within existence, not the surface of existence, but the depth existence cannot be just observed in a manner reminiscent of Galileo's watching an object fall from the tower in Pisa. Because for simple reason, because there is something which is not subject to observation. Of course, we may through such observation attain important data concerning the outside existence of man, but no glimpse into the depth of the personality will be afforded. The latter cannot be exposed and cannot be actually expressed. Only, how can I actually, if I want to know you're not your thought, I can, for instance, observe you, I mean, and I can make my deduction, some observation. I can observe your, the way your movement, your speech,
I mean, the handwriting and so forth. I mean, I can make certain deductions, but deductions will be just, I mean, as the surface of existence. Then I equate, I mean, your existence with your activity, like you saw. But I want to get a little bit deeper into you. So how, what can you do? You know that, I mean, social workers, etc., it's an interview business. What does an interview mean? I don't observe. I may observe during the interview, but this is not the main purpose of the interview. Interview means revelation. I have to ask this person to reveal itself to me. Otherwise, what is analysis? Revelation. There is something new which I cannot observe. But he has to reveal. It's an act already of communication. Willing, free communication. And I am always at liberty either to withhold communication or to pass on information. And here's where man is a liar. It's hard to trust him. The stone doesn't have to communicate. I read the information from the stone because the activity is subject to observation. I cannot grab it from a person because the person has within centeredness. The within centeredness cannot be just. I cannot observe. He has to communicate. It's an act only through active communication, through a willful bursting forth of the inmost, even hidden world of a person. It is possible to gain insight into a unique, one-timely, selfhood existence, which is focused not on the outside, but in itself. In short, the depth of the existence cannot be captured by an observer. An act of confession is necessary. Basically, this is confession. Any interview is a confession. When this mysterious personality steps freely closer to the surface and tries to reveal itself to the soul. When the eye turns from inner repose, toward the outside, then something intimate breaks through the crust of the surface and makes itself known to the other person. The parallelism is between divine revelation and human revelation. What does Judaism say? How do we know God? God revealed himself. If God hadn't willed to reveal himself, we wouldn't have known it. A person cannot know a person unless he reveals himself. The stone doesn't have to reveal himself. And of course, however, this process of communication is never an adequate one, gentlemen. The personal existence is unique, intimate, and strange. And it's very peculiarly felt and experienced by the eye. The thou can never share the intimate experience of the eye. It is insolubly bound up with the self. Only the eye knows himself as a self. And the knowledge, basically, is incommunicable to others. This is basically what Judaism stressed. Even when the eye is so to say, not frank. And truthful, and wants to confide in others, and tries to reveal to the Tao the inward existence, his soul. Even when he makes an honest effort to bear his soul, he can never transcend the threshold of aloneness. To transfer experiences to and interweave them into the existential texture of others. All he does, even a moment of frank confession and confidential communication, is he employs. How does a person confess? If I could tear my heart, as you say in the vernacular, and let other people take a look at my heart, perhaps they could find me. But how do I confess? How do I pour my heart? Through what? Through what media? Language. What is language? Language is not an individual medium. Language is a universal symbol. Language is nothing unique about language, you see. After all, I employ the behavioral language of the surface, the signs and metaphors, an outside existence in which an outside existence expresses itself, in activities, in manifestations, in words. And it's impossible for words to express whatever is within me, because the word is a standardized medium already. It's not a unique medium. The latter, the eye, is mute. And remains a personal, a perennial mystery to the outside world. Communication and self-revelation is to be considered as a noble attempt at self-transcendence. If man wants to transcend himself, and reveal himself to us.
However, a full communication is unattainable. The fullness of one's being, of one's personality, of his existential experience, will never be perceived by others. All a person can communicate to them are symbols and solid and symbols and signs which do not reflect this loneliness of man, means his uniqueness of man. And actually, the man remains in seclusion as an individual singular being. Only those, you see, take for instance psychoanalysis
also spoke about the subconscious and unconscious, but basically in psychoanalysis everything is expressive.
All right, man represses certain experiences, but he can bring them to the surface by certain methods. We say there is something in man which is inexpressible, not subconscious. The man is conscious. Hear that? We say the man is conscious, not subconscious. Perhaps he's subconscious too, but we don't care about it. The Judaism did not deal with this problem. He's conscious of it. But it's his exclusive possession. He cannot make this treasure available to us. He cannot express itself. Let us fool ourselves. I mean, in our daily interfaces, we find it. It is solitude. There are aspects of the personality which cannot be translated in universal experiences, standardized feelings, and awareness data. It cannot be passed on by the individual to his fellow man. And these are confined to the depth of personality. This is exactly what is important. So actually, now, let us see. This is loneliness. Loneliness means within existence. If a person would have only a surface existence, he would never be lonely. But he could communicate this to others. He would have no need for communication. It would have been observed, and captured by others, by just looking at him. But since he has to communicate his inner experiences, he cannot communicate. So he's lonely. There is a within existence which does not fit in into community. Because a community can only consist of people who have something in common which can communicate to each other where they are. But if each one of us has something which he cannot communicate, which cannot be perceived by others, it is an individual heart, of course, sounds strangely and uncommonly. Of course, an electrocardiogram will show you this sound of the heart. Yes, I'm just, of course, it's a metaphor. But how the heart, my rhythm of the heart, which only I feel, no one else, this I can't communicate. No electrocardiogram can get a picture of it. It is a communicating gesture of men who want to join the other self.